This program was recorded at InterVarsity's Following Christ Conference, held in Chicago, December 27th through 31st, 2008.
Good evening and welcome to the track for Natural Sciences and Mathematics. My name is Dwight Schwartz. I'm the sort of helper in this track. And I just want to introduce the chairperson of this track, Jennifer Wiseman. And she's going to come up and tell us a few things about the track tonight.
Welcome, everybody, to the best track. I'm just the messenger, but more people registered for this track than any other track. So what can we say? We have a really exciting program for this track. So you've chosen wisely, I believe. So, first of all, we're going to contemplate the entire universe. Everything from the very large to the very small. We're going to try to think about what the conference theme of human flourishing means for the study of science and mathematics and how we can engage in a way that's glorifying to God. So I'm counting noses. There's supposed to be about 130 of us, and I don't see 130 people here yet, so hopefully more will drift in. But we're very glad that you are here, and we're going to have a really good time together. I hope that this group will feel like your family within this larger conference and that you'll make some new friends in this group over the course of our track. So who are we here in this room? Let's just talk a little bit about that. I am the track chair, which means if there's something that you really don't like about the program, I will blame it on Dwight. So my field is astronomy. So I went to graduate school. I studied physics as an undergrad, astronomy as a graduate student. I've been to two of these Following Christ conferences before this one, so I think that means I've been to all of them. Yeah, okay. So I've enjoyed every single one of them, and I hope that this one is also enjoyable for you. I've had the chance to work in several different capacities, both as a research scientist at various astronomical institutions. I worked at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory and at Johns Hopkins University. I've also been very interested in science policy. So as my career progressed, I was able to find some positions that allowed me to think about the bigger picture of why we do science. And I was able to become what's called a Congressional Science Fellow and work on Capitol Hill for a little while and learn how our nation makes decisions on supporting science. I was able to work at NASA headquarters for several years as the program scientist for the Hubble Space Telescope program, which was a very interesting and challenging period of my life. And now I work at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, which is right outside of Washington, D.C. And at Goddard, we handle many of the science-oriented space satellite missions, including the Hubble Space Telescope and several other space telescopes, and also several Earth-observing satellites that are studying the Earth's oceans and atmospheres and climate. I grew up in the country. I love nature. So that's a little bit about me as the track chair. Our track point, who is the InterVarsity representative helping with this session, is Dr. Dwight Schwartz. And you can read here that he joined the staff of InterVarsity in 2003. He did his doctoral studies in chemical physics and did postdoctoral research teaching and ID support at Montana State University in Bozeman, Montana. So he's used to cold weather. Chicago's nothing, Dwight. Dwight, however, now is a campus staff member at Johns Hopkins University, working with faculty and graduate students at Johns Hopkins. And he is in the Baltimore area, also engaging, I think, with other campuses to some degree. I don't know, maybe informal. He and his wife, Maria, and Maria is also here at this conference. And she's working, let's see, under InterVarsity's Graduate and Fellowship Ministries as a volunteer. And Dwight and I are both members of the American Scientific Affiliation. There's a table here about the ASA in the near the bookstore on the seventh floor, and I hope you all will investigate that. We'll tell you a little bit more about that later on in the track. Okay, that's who we are. Who are you? You, and I should say we as a group, there are over 20 people in this room who are, or should be in this room, or are registered to be in this room, who are faculty or retired faculty members. I don't know how many faculty members are in here at the moment, but if you are a faculty or retired faculty person, could you raise your hand? Oh, wonderful. Yay. Okay. Excellent. All right. I was going to ask them to stand up, and I thought, oh, they're so old, they're not going to be able to. If you are a graduate student, would you stand up? Yes. Hey, all right. Okay. Have a seat. You're welcome. If you are an undergraduate student that has snuck into this conference, can you stand up, please? One. You're at least two. Yay! These are forward-thinking individuals, and we're glad you're here. If you are a postdoctoral scientist, could you or mathematician, could you stand up? Yay! If you consider yourself a professional, it doesn't fit into any of those other categories, or you're in ministry or some other vocation, I think other is a good thing because I'm in that other category as well. Could you stand up, please? Yes! All right. Other is good. Okay. So we'll be able to get to know a little bit more about each other when we break off at times into smaller group discussions where we can really meet one another. But just to continue this little confusion for a moment, out of my own curiosity, let's do a little discussion of what fields we're in. How many of you, you can raise your hand, are in chemistry or something related closely to chemistry? Great. Wonderful. Thank you. How many of you are in astronomy or astrophysics, something of that nature? Oh, hey, I'm like, oh, yeah. Okay, well, we'll maybe by the end of my talk we'll have a few more converts. How many people in physics other than astrophysics? Oh, wow, look at that. That's fantastic. Okay, really good. How about geology? Anybody in geology? Very good, welcome. How about biology? Where are biologists? And things related to that. How about these bridge fields? Biochemistry. Yes, all right. Or engineering physics or physical chemistry. Sort of figure out where to categorize yourself. Okay, what am I missing? What other fields are out there? Well, I'm getting to the math. I mean the science. The other scientific, non-mathematical sciences. What am I missing? Surely I've overlooked some of you.
Neuroscience.
Neuroscience, all right. Wave your hand, all right. You can be in more than one category, all right. How about any other medical or all, including all medical related, light-related sciences? Okay, very good. Okay, now let's turn to the great and perhaps more foundational field of the mathematical sciences. Excuse me? The queen of sciences. All right. Raise your hand if you are involved in the queen of sciences, mathematics. All right. Anybody here involved in computer science? All right. And Dwight kind of is too. All right. What else have I missed? How about theology of science? Anybody involved in sort of theological studies of science? We got a hand? Okay. Anything else? Any glaring oversight here? I'm sure all of you have your own sort of individual take on this, but we'll be able to discuss that. But anyway, you are all welcome. You see, we have a mixture of people at different stages of their career and different fields, and we're going to hopefully be a blessing to one another. The conference theme is human flourishing. So we have, you know, basic questions. What does it mean to flourish in or through or because of science and mathematics? And how can scientific and mathematical endeavors serve as vessels of our Christian worship, service, and identity? Have you ever thought about this? I mean, do you feel like you're flourishing when you're struggling to write an exam or get something to work in the lab? In fact, how many of you, and I don't want to show of hands for this one, although I should ask for one, but I won't. How many of you have ever, you know, perish the thought, but have ever reflected or wondered whether or not you were actually in the right field and whether you were actually cut out for this? How many of you may be struggling right this moment to decide whether you really feel like this is the career path for you? And that may be because you're an early in your student. It may be that you're well on in your career and this is not turning out the way you expected. So, you know, the sense of flourishing is not always there in a personal sense. And so part of this conference is to allow some time for reflection on your career path and how God is with you through the difficult times as well as the good times. How can science, mathematics, and technology be used to enable godly human flourishing and the flourishing of all creation? These are some of our thoughts. I want to just mention, I won't go through all this verbiage per se, but this is what was on the website for the conference about this track. So scientific discovery and technical innovation are changing and engaging our society at a pace never before known. On the scale of the universe, we've now detected whispers from the very dawn of time. In our own galaxy, we're beginning to detect other solar systems that may well be like our own. On the opposite scale, nanotechnology is enabling information transfer faster than ever imagined, and biological achievements raise questions about the very nature of life and the benefits and qualms we face in altering it. Nearly every issue facing the world today demonstrates the need for wise application of scientific and mathematical knowledge. How does a Christ-centered worldview engage and embrace our accelerated discoveries, capabilities, and understanding? So this track will address the excitement of scientific and mathematical achievement. See, I am going through all the verbiage. The interesting questions and dilemmas posed by current scientific endeavors and the Christian perspective on leading and participating in study and engagement with the natural world. We will work to understand the problems in those disciplines that hinder human flourishing and to propose solutions to these problems. I was looking at that today and I was like, we're going to solve all of human problems in this track? Who wrote that? I did. Considering how the natural sciences and mathematics can help humans to engage the natural world and to flourish within it. Okay. And finally, we will look at forefront discoveries in several realms of science and technology, and we'll discuss how God's call upon our lives can guide our choices of research focus and the way we engage a career in mathematics or science as a channel of service at both the global and personal levels. Okay, and on we can talk about these different settings, the classroom, the laboratory, the church, and how we can engage and experience God's help in our daily work. So that's what this track is about, and I hope that you will gain something great and life-changing about it. Here's the plan for our track. We're right in the middle of Sunday evening. We call it day one. Welcome, introductions, and announcements. Then I'm going to give maybe about a 20-minute discussion on scientific discovery and flourishing, lessons from the universe. Day two, which is tomorrow, in the morning, and also on Tuesday morning, from 10:30 to 11:30, we're going to have, like every other track, a Bible study, a manuscript Bible study. You have the Bible manuscript. It was given to you when you registered in your pack there. We will be right here in this room, so that's easy to remember, just from 10:30 to 11:30, the Bible manuscript study. Monday afternoon, that's tomorrow afternoon, we have a long session here, and it's going to be great, between 1:30 and 5. We will have two speakers. Our first speaker will be Dr. Jim Bradley, and he will provide us a talk called Ideas in the Mind of God, a Christian Reflection on Mathematics. Jim, are you here?
Okay, he's back there. Very good. And the second talk will be by Dr. Catherine Crouch. Her talk is called Discipleship in the Laboratory in the Classroom, and she has a better talk. It's called Experiencing God's Grace or something like that. She will tell you the real title tomorrow. Catherine, can you raise your hand? Very good. And then also tomorrow we will have some small group discussion times, break times, including a faculty breakout time when those of you who are faculty members can sit and talk together without the embarrassment of students hearing what your life is really like. And we'll have some good times tomorrow. Before I go on, I have overlooked a very important thing, which is that I would like Dwight to come up and tell us a little bit further about his reflections on what human flourishing means in terms of science. Can you come up and do that for a moment?
I just think that we throw this word around, and I have this feeling that at least some of you really don't know what that means. And so I'm going to give you my two cents, and you can take from that what you will. But so this is my operational definition of human flourishing. Human flourishing means thriving physically, socially, intellectually, and spiritually according to God's design for you as an individual, as a member of a family, as a member of other communities, as a member of the body of Christ, as a practitioner of God-given vocations and avocations, and of course becoming more and more a lover of God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. In the lingo of InterVarsity, we like to talk about loving God, God's Word, God's people of every ethnicity and culture, and God's purposes in the world, some of which include your engagement in your vocation. And a much more stylized way to say all that is to say that I'm going to live so God can use me. You know, if you remember the song from the end of the plenary session. So I just encourage you to be thinking about some meaningful operational definition of flourishing and how that is going to work and play out as you experience and as we experience together this track. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Dwight. Okay, we will have a closing track session on Tuesday evening after the final plenary talk, which will be by Dr. Francis Collins, who was the director of the Human Genome Project. He gives a fantastic talk. I look forward to it. And he will join several others, including our guest speakers and more, for a little panel discussion where you can ask further questions of any of our speakers at that time, and they'll give us some of their thoughts, closing thoughts on human flourishing, and their thoughts of encouraging for us. On that last night, we would also like to announce to you some opportunities that you have for Christian service in mathematics or in science, and connections, fellowship with other Christians in science and math. So we would love for you to give us suggestions of things that should be shared with this entire group that might be of interest to this entire group. If you have an idea of an organization or an opportunity for service that you think would be relevant to this track, please come and tell either Dwight or myself, and we may ask you to stand up and give a 1 to 2 minute spiel about this on Tuesday evening during that time. We'll give more thorough introductions of our speakers tomorrow afternoon, but Dr. Catherine Crouch is an assistant professor of physics at Swarthmore College. Her research is in experimental condensed matter physics, and she's also very involved in engaging students in mentoring and in developing teaching methods that really actively engage students. Her real title, she tells me, which is much more beautiful than the one that I told you, is Creating a Culture of Grace in the Laboratory and the Classroom. Doesn't that sound great? And Dr. Jim Bradley is Vice President for the Physical and Mathematical Sciences at the John Templeton Foundation. He's responsible for creating these large-scale funding initiatives in the mathematical and physical sciences. And he's also been a professor of mathematics and statistics at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He has many, many other attributes to his background, and we'll give the full introduction tomorrow. So these talks are going to be great. You don't want to miss out. Finally, there's always going to be announcements. One of them is, if you would like company at mealtimes, please just linger around after our sessions. Like in the mornings, we'll have these manuscript studies, and after they're over, if you just hang out here a few minutes, you can meet up with other people who are also lingering around looking for company, and then you can go to lunch together, you know, form groups to go out and get to know each other. I suggest during the mornings you might want to bring your jacket with you to the session so that you, being well prepared, can go off to lunch and not have to wait on these elevators that take forever and ever to go get your coat. But that's your choice. Also, tomorrow afternoon, at the end of the afternoon session, we can form groups here if you're looking for company to sit with at dinner. So just a thought. Also, there is a focus group that's being formed for a special dinner table on Tuesday evening, and we've been asked to announce this to the track and to request that we have one or two volunteers who would be willing to sit on a focus group discussing Asian ministries and ministry to and through the Asian community in Christian academia. So if you feel like you would like to volunteer for that kind of discussion group, please come up and talk to me or to Dwight, and we will send your name in to join that group. Okay, am I missing anything, Dwight? Okay. So I'm going to move now into a little opening talk that I'm going to give, which will be hopefully just to get you thinking a little bit about your own field as well. My field being astronomy, I'm going to talk about scientific discovery and flourishing, lessons from the universe, or how can basic study of the universe contribute to human flourishing. And with that, I'm going to close this one out. This is me again, part two. Okay. I want to tell you a little bit about some of the discoveries in astronomy, because first of all, I think they're great. I'm a little biased. And also, I think it can maybe hopefully kind of prime the pump. So for this part of the talk, we need the lights to go down. This is not permission for you to go to sleep. This is a spiral galaxy. It's what we call a barred spiral galaxy. Since there's only three astronomers in the room, I maybe have to have some more remedial discussion here. Galaxies are made of stars. Galaxies have more, I bet you didn't know this, they have much more gas and dust in them than they have stars. And they come in different shapes and sizes, but many of them have this spiral structure with spiral arms, and some of them have a long bar structure in the middle. Almost all of them have a dense cluster of stars in the core, and the light becomes all blended together. We call it the halo of the core of the galaxy. This is an example of a cluster of stars, just a standard cluster in our own galaxy, but I like it because it just shows you the enormous diversity and beauty of stars. Most often in biblical scripture, there's lots of things in scripture about the heavens, and there are some miraculous events recorded. The heavens are sometimes used in terms of prophecy or in other ways, but most of the time in scripture they're mentioned in the context of praise. And Psalm 19 is an example. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the skies proclaim the work of His hands. Day after day they pour forth speech, and night after night they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the end of the world. This passage is so true. It's not only just poetic, but academically, when we study the heavens as scientists, we have colleagues, I have colleagues, collaborators all over the world. We're all looking at the same objects in the sky using the same tools. And even though we come from different language backgrounds, different cultural and religious backgrounds, we're hearing the same voice. We're seeing the same information. And I like that. And I also sense around the world a general sense of wonder and awe by looking at the universe, looking at the sky. Sadly, many people around the world now, perhaps fewer than ever in history, are able to see the sky because we have so many lights now and so much pollution. And together, those two factors are darkening the sky for many, many people around the world who don't have the freedom to go to a dark place on vacation. They have never seen the beauty of the night sky, and I believe they're missing out on a voice that is heralding the presence of God by not being able to see the heavens. Let's go on a little quick tour here of the universe from different perspectives. This is the Hubble Space Telescope. It's a satellite that's orbiting the Earth right now. It's operating right this minute and sending back images back to Earth. It is in need of a little bit of attention. A couple of its instruments are not fully functioning. It needs new batteries and things. So we're planning to send astronauts back up to Hubble in a few months to put in some new batteries and new cameras, and it will continue to operate for several more years, we're hoping. So using this and some other telescopes, I'm going to show you some images of the heavens. And when I say from different perspectives, I don't mean different directions in this point. I'm talking about some more qualitative perspectives. One of them is magnitude. I've already showed you this cluster, but I just want, many of you are too young to remember Carl Sagan and his billions and billions of stars. He did a program called Cosmos on public television when I was growing up, and he was famous for saying that there are billions and billions of stars and billions of galaxies, and it's true. So this image has at least thousands of stars, and what can you say about what you see just from looking at this picture? What can you tell me about stars just by looking at this picture?
Different colors,
that's absolutely right. I know the lighting is not just great, but there's blue, orange, red, yellow. What else? What else do you see about these stars? They're different brightnesses, and that sometimes appears as different sizes. Now, in astronomy, you never know that third dimension, so you don't know if a bright thing is closer to you, and that's why it looks brighter, or whether it's actually intrinsically brighter than its neighbors. And in this case, this is a cluster. It's a star cloud where all the stars are basically more or less the same distance from us. So in this case, we do know that the stars are all basically the same distance, so a brighter-looking star actually is intrinsically brighter. And a red-looking star actually is intrinsically redder than the others. So stars come in a tremendous variety, and even St. Paul in one of his letters says that star differs from star in splendor, so even he knew that. So there are a whole lot of stars. This is just one little cluster. There's, in fact, 100 billion stars in a typical galaxy. This is another spiral galaxy called the Whirlpool, and we think that our Milky Way looks something like this. Spiral arms, beautiful dense core, and most of the volume taken up by dust and gas, with new stars forming out of that material in the arms of the galaxy. This is the sort of humbling ooh-ah necessary slide for astronomy. We use light years because these numbers are so huge that they don't work well in astronomy. You all know that. So if Earth is 150 million kilometers from the Sun, and Pluto is 6 billion kilometers from the Sun, and Pluto is still there, it hasn't changed. We have to use light years because, 10 million million kilometers doesn't make a lot of sense to keep using. So we use light years, and the nearest star is 4 of these light years away. That's Proxima Centauri. Our Milky Way galaxy of stars, which has about 100 billion of those stars, is from side to side about 150,000 light years across. So it takes that long from a star on one side when its light to reach the other side of our own galaxy. And now if we look at our nearest neighbor spiral galaxy, which is Andromeda, that's 2 million light years away. So you're seeing Andromeda as it looked 2 million years ago, if you want to think of it that way. And we now can see galaxies at distances of several billion light years away, And of course, we're seeing them also as they looked back then. And we can see the nearby galaxies and the more distant galaxies at the same time. So we're seeing sort of time all simultaneously when we look at the sky with telescopes. There are about 100 billion galaxies and about 100 billion stars in each one, meaning there are roughly something like 10,000 billion billion stars in the universe, and our sun is one of them. Okay, so, you know, God is pretty awesome. Yes? Dwight says that's a tenth of a mole, okay? Is that helpful? Thank you, Dwight. Dwight has the gift of speaking in tongues. All right. This may be hard to see with this the spotlight here, but this is another image. But this, in this one, the dots of light you see here are not stars. The dots of light are each an entire galaxy. So what they did with the Hubble Space Telescope was point it at a kind of an empty direction of space, or not, I shouldn't say empty, but a kind of a direction where it didn't have any nearby stars, and let it just sit there for several days collecting light so that we could see the dimmest objects and just see what would show up. And, you know, it was predicted that you would see a sky full of galaxies, but still to see it is kind of amazing. This is just a sort of pencil beam direction in space, but imagine this extrapolated across the whole sky. And so each one of these objects is a galaxy. You see a big spiral there and a spiral galaxy there. Each one of these little dots of light that look like noise, they're actually entire galaxies on their own. Some of these are very distant. The reddened ones are dragged along with the expansion of space, and their light becomes Doppler shifted or stretched along with the expansion of space, so they appear redder to us than the more nearby ones. And you see a lot of interesting sort of fragments of galaxy in the more distant universe. So this is quite an amazing image showing us the magnitude of the universe. When we look from the perspective of beauty, we can see some of the same things. This is the same star cluster again, but I don't often get as in scientific research to talk about topics of beauty, things like that, but for talks like this, I enjoy savoring it. And I believe that the colors of stars and the shapes of galaxies are intrinsically very beautiful. And one of the gifts God has given us is the ability to recognize that beauty and that order. Here's another spiral galaxy. This is one of my favorites. It has the beautiful name NGC 1309. Astronomers are not real good with poetry. But there's nothing special about this galaxy except that I just find it enormously beautiful. It's symmetric. It's got that beautiful, bright center. And we believe most galaxies have black holes buried in the center. But what I find also beautiful about this image is the background stuff. All these little blips in the background are other galaxies. And if you could see the better image on the screen here, you would see a whole bunch of these beautiful galaxies that are just the background noise to this image. And I find that tremendously beautiful. We look at progression. We can look at that same type of image that shows you these galaxies and pull out the ones that are the most reddened, meaning they are the most distant in space. This got corrupted in the transfer of my presentation to this laptop, so this is a mess. But you can still get the idea. What's going on here is that scientists have looked at the most reddened objects, which are circled in green here and magnified over here as green circles. They are little red things, and if you could see them up close, you would find out that galaxies that are very distant in space, which also means they're very distant back in time, they don't look like the galaxies of our own time. They don't look like the Milky Way. They don't look like nearby galaxies. They are small. They are ratty looking. They're not fully formed. They don't have that beautiful spiral structure. And if you do a chemical analysis of their makeup, the stars in them are almost all completely hydrogen and a little bit of helium, which were the original elements in the universe. It's taken generations of stars in these galaxies and the chemical processes that go on through a star's life cycle to produce the heavier elements such as carbon and iron that we enjoy now in our own galaxy and that we need for life in our own solar system. So you can see a kind of progression in the universe. Here's one of these ratty early galaxies that hasn't completely formed its structure yet. It takes some time for these swirling collections of gas and stars to take on that spiral structure. We can even see, by looking around at all directions in space with special telescopes, we can see remnants of the very beginning of creation. And to me, this is just an awesome testament to the fact that our particular universe is not stagnant. It has a beginning point. And there may be other universes, but they've had their beginning points too. So this is a background image that I can explain to you after the talk if you want to know more information. But basically, it's showing you the remnant background radiation from the Big Bang, and the colors here represent slight temperature variations in that background as measured by a satellite known as WMAP. And that variation is crucial to the development of clusters of galaxies and stars later on in the universe. And in fact, we've now kind of can figure out a sort of timeline from now with our satellites like Hubble and WMAP, looking back through recent history where we have galaxies, well-formed galaxies, to more distant history where the galaxies look kind of ratty and they're not as well-formed, to the first stars, the first giant stars that were forming before there were full galaxies, and then the early period before there were even molecules that were able to form clouds and stars. We have only ionized gas from the very beginning. There's a lot we don't know about this period, and they're building telescopes, or we're developing telescopes now to study that very early stages of the universe. Okay, activity. We see galaxies, especially those more distant galaxies, because the universe has been expanding over time. So if you look back in time, the universe was in fact smaller. And galaxies actually had more chances to feel each other gravitationally. So sometimes the gravitational attraction of two galaxies would overcome the overall expansion that tends to push galaxies apart. So we see mergers of galaxies. These are two galaxies that are being pulled together by their mutual gravity. When galaxies merge, the stars don't tend to collide with one another because most of the volume is actually empty space. But they create a havoc with the structure of these galaxies because the tidal forces pull the spiral arms apart, pull the stars apart, and make a general mess. Here's two galaxies that are further along in that merging process. They've gotten too close. The merging process and the tidal forces and gravitational attraction spurs a whole new wave of star formation, which is caused whenever you get compression of gas in these galaxies. It's a very active and exciting place to be. And within our own Milky Way galaxy, we have plenty of these interstellar gas clouds that are lit up from new stars that have just formed and are ionizing the gas in the cloud. There, behind this Orion Nebula, which is lit up by young, fully formed stars, there's an entire dark cloud that I've studied with radio telescopes in which there are what we call protostars. These are clumps of gas that are collapsing and have not yet turned on to form stars, but they're on their way to that future. It's a very active and exciting place to look. And then old stars start losing their outer atmospheres as they run out of fuel in their inner core, and that can be quite beautiful as well. Someone thought that this star losing its outer atmosphere looked like a cat's eye, so they called this the Cat's Eye Nebula. And then large stars that become unstable will explode in what's called a supernova. And this supernova happened about 1,000 years ago, and we still see the debris from it today. So this is a Hubble Space Telescope image of the debris of a star that went supernova 1,000 years ago. It's called the Crab Nebula now. And what I like about this is that this explosion, this event, was observed by Chinese astronomers when it happened 1,000 years ago. And it's been monitored by astronomers around the world ever since. So people have watched this debris expand from this particular event ever since, and we're still following it. So this is something that actually occurred in written human history. Okay, there's mystery in our universe. Mystery meaning there's a whole lot we don't know, and we don't know. We see gravitational pull of things that are causing galaxies to rotate, indicating that there's mass in these galaxies that don't show up as stars or gas or dust or anything that we understand. We call that dark matter, and that appears to be about 22% of the entire composition of mass and energy in the universe. And now, over the last few years, we've discovered something far more mysterious, which is that the universe as a whole appears to be not only expanding, but accelerating. Now, when I was in school, the big question was, will the universe expand forever and slow down, or will it expand, but gravity not only slow it down, but gravity be strong enough to pull everything back together as a big crunch? Those were the two choices, because gravity only pulls things together. And recently, by careful observations of distant galaxies and stellar explosions in those distant galaxies to gauge the brightness and the distance of these objects compared to more nearby galaxies, astronomers have found that the universe has not only been expanding over time, but that expansion is accelerating. And we don't have any explanation for something that would work on that large of a scale that would cause the acceleration of the universe. So it's been given the descriptive name dark energy, because we don't know what it is. So that's a hot topic in physics and astrophysics these days. And in fact, NASA, my own agency, is working very hard to develop a new space telescope that will study more precisely this accelerating quality of the universe and see how that compares to the clustering of galaxies over time, which has happened in order for us to get galaxies and galaxy clusters that we now have. So there's a competition between the dark energy, which is pushing things apart, and gravity, which is trying to cluster things together, to try to compare those two and see how they worked over time. But this is a big mystery. You know, the stuff we understand, baryons, is only, you know, 4.4% of the universe. We know something about neutrinos. Much of this we don't know. Much of the high energy collider facilities are trying to understand some of the subatomic particle physics and so forth that might explain some of this, and it's just a mystery. So there's still a lot of work to be done. Get your grants, okay? Yes, so we have to maintain a sense of humility and curiosity. All right, so does the character of the heavens reflect the character of their creator? I mean, these are kinds of questions that, you know, that I don't get asked during the course of my sort of professional research. But when we're allowed to sort of think above and beyond that, this is a good question. It does help for us to remember that science, as you know, is limited to questions of sort of how things happened and when they happened and why, and in terms of physical cause and effect. Questions that are addressable within the realm of natural law. That's what science is set up for. And our faith can address questions like why, you know, is there purpose? And who? Is there something or someone behind all these things? Spiritual insights. So I don't believe that science is all there is. That would be scientism. But we can, within the realm of our spiritual discussions, move even beyond science to ask these questions. You know, is there something about the character of the heavens that reflects something about what we believe from our faith? Is there creator? And we receive these kinds of truths, both spiritual and scientific truths, from nature and from scripture. And we need to be very careful as we're interpreting both of these, because we understand that scientists can, by the very nature of science, are constantly learning how to refine and correct understandings of nature. And likewise, we need to be very careful with how we understand and interpret scripture and our spiritual insights. With that as a preface, I believe that if we believe in a God who made the heavens, then from astronomical observation and the resulting inference, that God appears to be, and I just threw out some of these off the top of my own head, you could probably think of more, but God appears to be powerful and creative and the creator and lover of beauty. God is patient. We've had, we believe, 13.7 billion years since the dawn of creation so far. And, you know, we've only been here a small part of that. God has been very patient in allowing his universe to become the place that we can thrive in. God has been faithful with fundamental laws and with time. We don't have our fundamental physical laws changing every moment. And in fact, our moments, as we experience them, progress in a faithful manner so that we can understand cause and effect. I believe that God, we can be seen to be desiring freedom within that context of faithfulness. So there are physical mechanisms through which there are some freedoms that allow diversity and change to occur. Quantum theory and chaos, for example. It appears that God is one who gives and enables life. Our universe, by definition, the fact that we're in here, our universe supports life, and maybe life elsewhere, who knows? And that our God is one who loves and enables us to investigate and appreciate and understand the magnificent cosmos of which we are a part. And then furthermore, as Christians, we can contemplate and reflect on the fact that Jesus is the focus of the cosmos from the beginning of time, not just a kind of cosmic afterthought. And the scriptures say that in these last days, God has spoken to us by His Son, whom He appointed the heir of all things, and through whom He made the universe. And that this Son is the radiance of God's glory. It sustains all things by His powerful word. So sometimes it's very hard to equate the Jesus who, you know, walked on the Sea of Galilee with the one who is responsible for the creation and sustaining of the universe. And yet we're told it's the same Christ. Okay, so general themes about the heavens that the Bible gives us is that God is responsible for the heavens and everything we find in nature, and God is pleased with discovery and good stewardship. And I remember in Genesis, one of the things God asked Adam to do was to name all the animals, and it seemed that he gained pleasure from Adam looking at the animals and giving them descriptive names. And in some sense, that's what we do in astronomy. We have red giants and white dwarfs and this kind of thing. And we have our own planet to take care of, and I believe stewardship is a mandate. We explore. I'm going to try to go a little quicker here because we need to finish. I believe exploration is a godly thing, and so there's our Hubble again, and we have Mars rovers that are continuing to drive around on the surface of Mars and send back pictures, and it's a kind of an issue for NASA because they won't die. They keep going. They're supposed to live 3 years. 3 months has been well over 3 years, so they explore, and they explore, and they explore. In my own lab, we are looking for evidence of planets around other stars. So, you know, we know there are planets in our own solar system, and now we're finding evidence of planets around other stars. We find them by looking, for example, at the motions of stars that can only be explained if there's a planet that's gravitationally tugging on that star with a mutual gravitational attraction. We're working on telescopes that will be able to actually take images of planets around other stars that are Earth-like planets. And in fact, we are already starting, I'll show you in a second, to be able to image some of these giant planets. I like this idea of exploring other worlds is not new. And so Thomas Wright in the 18th century was contemplating this idea that there might be many suns. And he decided that, you know, if you think, think of him as like thinking stream of consciousness here. If you admit the breadth of the Via Láctea, which is the Milky Way, to be at mean maybe 9 degrees, and if you suppose that there's 1,200 stars in every square degree, then there'll be nearly, in that whole area, about 3,880,000 stars, all these in a very minute portion of that great expanse of heaven. What a vast idea of endless beings must this produce and generate in our minds. And when we consider them all as flaming suns, progenitors, prima mobilis of a still much greater number of people worlds, what less than an infinity can circumscribe them? What less than an eternity comprehend them? What less than omnipotence produce and support them? And where can our wonder cease? Amen. So that was the excitement of the 18th century. I think we should have the same excitement now. And in fact, my own lab, scientists in my own group, were collaborators on a recent discovery of an actual image planet. This is a star that's blocked out by a coronagraph, so you only see this kind of weird refracted light around the edge of the coronagraph. You don't see the star. You see this ring of disk debris around the star, which is real, and buried in that disk here, over time, they've seen what is a large, giant Jupiter-like planet that's moving in its orbit around this ring. So that's an advance. We hope someday to be able to see if there are Earth-like planets out there. Okay, so I mentioned I think I'm going to just close this up. We do wonder if we're significant, and our significance is in astronomy, not based on where we are in the universe or how long we've been here, because we're not special in that sense. But we are very significant in terms of the fact that we don't know if there's any other life, and also in our own theology, we believe that God has chosen us to be made in His image, to be able to investigate and learn from the universe. And I believe astronomical discovery can contribute to human flourishing by, for example, uplifting our spirits and our sights, teaching us about the nature of ourselves and our place in the universe and space and time, telling us something about the nature of God, and more. Okay? Now, that's astronomy. In fact, John Calvin said, astronomy is not only pleasant, but it's also useful to be known. It cannot be denied that this art unfolds the admirable wisdom of God. There you have it. What about your field? Okay? How can work in your field contribute to or detract from human flourishing and the flourishing of all creation? And we'll be thinking about this through tomorrow and the next day as well. We've only got 5 minutes left. I was hoping we'd have more like 20 minutes for this. And also, there were supposed to be tables in this room, and there are no tables. So what I would like you to do, just for the next maybe 10 minutes, and we'll just end 5 minutes late here, is to gather, turn your chairs around in groups of maybe 5 or 6 or 8, introduce yourselves, and talk about something that's interesting in your own research, and maybe even how it might contribute to this idea of flourishing. And I will cut you off in 10 minutes. Okay?